Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. I don't know about you all, but I really need a break from the constant bombardment of bad news. So today I'm offering two of my favorite shows over these 5 years. We've had many, many wonderful shows, and these are two of my favorite shows. Our first guest is going to be filmmaker Helena Norberg Hodge, who made one of my favorite documentaries called The Economics of Happiness. And right after Helena, we'll be back with one of my favorite guests and one of the nicest people I've ever had on the soapbox, actor, author, comedian, Richard Belzer. And Richard's going to talk about the book he co-wrote called Dead Wrong, Straight Facts About the Country's Most Controversial Cover-Ups. And Richard is a dedicated, articulate, a deep thinker. And like I said, he really was one of the nicest people I've ever had on the soapbox. We had technical difficulties doing his the interview, but he was so kind and understanding and flexible. And I've had some people who have not been that kind, understanding, or flexible when you know, stuff happens, as it always happens. So anyway, stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Helena Norberg Hodge. And then stay tuned after that, and you'll hear my interview with Richard Belzer.
Helena, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
It's good to have you back on. We really admire your work and your documentary. But am I right? Are you in Australia today?
I am in Australia. That's where I'm living, far, far away.
Uh-huh, from us, at least.
So anyway,
we're talking to you because you're having a conference here about the economics of happiness in Berkeley, California. But before we get into that and you tell us about your conference, can you tell us what you think about the Occupy movement and especially how it's related to your movement, the localization movement?
Yes, absolutely. I think the Occupy movement, as I'm sure you do too, is just the most exciting and encouraging thing that we've seen for a very long time. And it's very much related to what we're about. In my organization, you know, we've been saying for years that it's less than 1% of the global population that's promoting policies that are destructive to the 99% of the global population, but also threatening our very survival because of the impact on the environment. We are also very clear about the fact that the corporate rule that we have now, from my native country of Sweden to India to China and to the U.S., it's the corporate rule, the big banks and corporations behind the scenes that are really pulling the strings. We have this insane redundant trade where things are being flown back and forth. You know, apples are being flown also from England to be washed in South Africa and flown back again.
Oh, wow.
Corporate global economy is the main reason for global warming and other environmental crises. So we're promoting the understanding that in really seeing how the corporations gain so much power over our governments, it's the globalization of the economy, it's the deregulation of trade and finance that's the main problem. So we very much hope to join with the Occupy movement, and there will be people from that at our conference, to spell out that what we need to do immediately is to localize economic activity to the greatest extent possible, particularly starting with food, which is, of course, the only thing human beings produce that every single person on the planet needs every single day. So having that food from closer to home obviously makes sense. I could say
absolutely
a lot more, but I guess I'm not monologue you too much.
No, it's okay. I just want you to tell us, what do you hope that your collaboration with the Occupy movement here in the U.S. will do to address those issues?
Well, I think, you know, what I've been saying is that I think that once we get a very clear signal, which the Occupy movement is sending now, that even in the Western countries, even within the U.S., the majority of people are being marginalized and impoverished by so-called economic growth. By keeping this system going, people are getting poorer. Once that message gets out and it gets linked to the environmental concerns, it gets linked to the concern, as you have shown, to the war machine and how the war machine is part of protecting corporate interests. It's not about our needs. It's not about our need for oil. It's about the corporate machine's need for oil. So once we start linking that, those issues, to understand that every single person who is working at this stage, and thank goodness there are still so many millions of people who are, working to make the world a better place, whether concerns are mainly about the environment or mainly about poverty or about peace instead of war, once we link hands to focus on economic change, I think we'll see, you know, there's this huge, the movement multiply and grow very, very rapidly.
Well, and we see, you talked about the, you know, connection to war and how the 1% or the less than 1% actually are the ones that benefit from war. They don't have to sacrifice for war. What do you think about, especially here in the United States? Well, we can look at the United States and we can look at Greece, for example. The oppression by the police and military of these protests. And the United States, I, you know, have to say that the protests have been more than 99% peaceful, but they've been violently, you know, oppressed by the police state. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm afraid that this is definitely happening, and which is why I would argue that the most important thing about the Occupy movement is to keep the vision and the ideas alive, to keep a clear message going, and why it's so important, you know, that you have a radio, because we have to recognize that the dominant media are part of the problem, and so we need alternative media. We need everyone to realize that they can be an information activist. They can get this understanding out so that, as I say, so that there's a linking of hands across, not just across the social and environmental divide. And this divide, by the way, you know, is created by the corporate agenda, which pretends that those who are concerned with the environment are elitists who don't care about the fact that we need growth to reduce poverty, that we need large-scale industrial farming to feed the world. You know, all kinds of myths prop this system up and keep us divided. So we've got to see through that and have a more holistic view. And I do think our film can help people to start seeing those linkages so that we can link hands. And even across the right and left, across the Democrat and conservative divide, many of the conservatives are absolutely fed up with government bureaucracy, government waste. And of course, that's true. There is a reason to be fed up with that, but they need to recognize that the real problem is that they're in the pockets of the giant banks and corporations, and that we have to see, understand the system in order to change it. And I do think that the localization or decentralization that's so essential for environmental reasons, but also to allow literally millions of smaller businesses to flourish, billions of jobs to be available. You know, the job scarcity is completely artificial. There is no job scarcity in reality. I think once people see that, as I say, we'll see, you know, this linking of hands that's essential to make real change. I think, and to make real change, you know, we are also in the film spelling out that you can start right now at the local level. So you can already start joining the localization movement and prove that it's possible to support farmers to diversify and sell closer to home, and that this can increase their profit while it reduces the price of healthy food to you, the consumer. You can actually be part of a movement that creates more jobs and more community. So I think with our film and now the conference I think we are bringing together those, what has been, you know, divided, these diverse movements into this umbrella of looking at the economy, at changing the economy. And again, the Occupy movement has been, you know, we mustn't despair at the fact that this sort of police state terrorism really is trying to break it up. We must rejoice in the fact that they managed to get this message out to so many people. We must rejoice in the fact that so many people were supportive of the movement. And I think we have to find a way of having it live on in every local community, in every home, in everybody's minds, so that it may not be necessary to have people sleeping out in the cold and snow to keep this movement alive. It shouldn't be necessary.
Right, and the one thing I like about, well, I like a lot of you know, things about the Occupy movement, but the thing that I like is it is decentralized, and it has been tailored by necessity to you know, respond to the needs of the local community, not necessarily, you know, in a national political way, but since it is decentralized, that it is so diverse. And it is focusing, many of them are focusing on local issues, whether their immediate needs, as preventing someone from being foreclosed on, or working on things that might be more of a long-term solution. So I'm glad that you, you know, gave us your thoughts about that. And
I just want to say that localization is synonymous with decentralization. That's really...
Yes.
It's another word for the same thing, and that is exactly what it allows, is for greater diversity and greater empowerment of more people rather than hierarchical systems.
And I'm glad that you contacted me about this conference, and I just want to tell you that I'm probably one of your biggest cheerleaders over here whenever I speak, because I speak about these issues, and I have been for probably like you know, at least the last 3 or 4 years now, is I talk about the movie, and I recommend, if people haven't seen it, that, you know, even though my audiences are really smart and they're really aware of a lot of things, and a lot of people have seen the film, but I always tell people that that this is the direction that we need to be going in. So tell my listeners and me about the upcoming Economics of Happiness Conference in Berkeley. Is this something you do around the world? And then you can give specifics of this conference.
We have done conferences before around the world, but it's hard, of course, to raise funding, and sometimes people feel these days, you know, it's not important. But we have always felt that it's particularly important to get across this divide between the so-called developed and the developing world, because there's so many myths about how, you know, in China and India, they need more fossil fuels and should be allowed to keep polluting longer because it would be unjust to us and to reduce CO2 emissions. There are all kinds of myths that are really about the corporate need to produce over there where labor is cheaper. And, of course, that's taking our jobs away from us, and it's creating vastly more pollution. So this dialogue between the developed and the developing world is something that we have tried to encourage over now 3 decades, because we've been working, you know, both in the so-called developing world and in the developed world. So that's what this conference is about, once again bringing people together from around the world. And the conference starts on the 22nd in Berkeley with a film showing, with our film and another very important film, Schooling the World. It shows how even the schools are part of the problem, something that's hard for people to see in the West. But in the third world, it's very clear that the schools become a way of training people essentially for these jobs as in the factories and corporate system, and that they they're eradicating literally tens of thousands of years of knowledge about their own ecosystem, their own culture, their own history. So it becomes part of the problem. Anyway, that's the film. Schooling the World and Economics of Happiness will be on the evening of the 22nd, And then we have, starting Friday evening, the conference, and with people like Charles Eisenstein, you might have heard of, and Annie Leonard of The Story of Stuff, as well as people like Manish Jain from India, Anuradha Mittal, Sulak Sivaraksa. He's a leader, he's from Thailand, and he's a leader in the engaged Buddhist movement. One of the things that we've always been about is understanding the need for paying attention to the personal inner life, the psychological and spiritual dimension, at the same time as we develop and strengthen our political and economic activism. So again, we feel this bridging of the personal and spiritual and the political and economic is absolutely crucial. You know, you may have found that too. There's been a tendency for people to think, well, we could, you know, peace starts with myself, and therefore I'll only focus on meditating and my own spiritual journey. And very often that's made people apathetic politically. And on the other hand, you know, we've had activists who have become completely burned out because they haven't paid attention to their need for quieting the mind and for having, you know, for paying attention to that inner peace, which will give them the joy and the power to continue with their work. So the conference, I think, is unique in that way.
Okay, you just had elections. Well, Australia just had elections. And if you haven't, in case you haven't heard, there's elections coming up in the United States. You know, for the manager of what I call, you know, the CEO of the empire. And I truly believe that the president of the United States is actually selected by the 1%. And it doesn't matter if the Republican or Democrat wins, the agenda of the 1% is going to be furthered. And, you know, I don't know, to me, I don't get too involved in these federal political things because I think they have very little effect on our lives. That we can do more locally. What is your thoughts? Yes. What are your thoughts on that?
I completely agree, and it becomes, I think, particularly clear when you see it internationally, because the same thing has happened, you know, in Sweden and in India, and I think you're absolutely right. We've got to start, I think the economic literacy that we're talking about is understanding that this concentration of big banks and corporations, the 1% that inhabits those, that are the leaders in those, are the ones who are pulling the strings and, yes, electing our leaders across the world. So once we realize that more clearly, it's a very different agenda. We've got to build up a movement that will articulate this very clearly and that will put in place new representatives or force the current representatives to represent us instead of this invisible economic hand. And that could be done, you know, with more alert understanding of what's actually going on. It could be done, and I do think that within a very short period, if we could focus more on raising awareness about what's actually happening, and I agree, you know, if people really understood what was happening, they would not be investing so much energy in the elections as they are currently being run. And we've seen again and again that as people are on the election tour, they speak our language because they're trying to get our votes, the 99% vote.
Absolutely.
But in actual fact, once they're in power, we see who the real power is. And so this, if we understand that clearly, we will be demanding fundamental change. And for me, it is, you know, one of the first things is an immediate re-regulation of the global economic activity. That means regulating the giants instead of over-regulating small local business. It's a bit technical, but this is one of the points that most people do not pay attention to and do not understand, and that is that worldwide, our activities as individuals and smaller local businesses, even national businesses, are being strangled by bureaucracy and red tape, they're being strangled and over-regulated. This often leads them to become right-wing, to want what they believe is the way forward, which is a laissez-faire, free trade economy. And they don't understand that we've got to, again, spell out this difference between the giant players at the global level versus the smaller local and national players.
Well, Helena, of course, your movie and your work is doing a lot in this education piece. And if my listeners wanted more information about the conference here in the States in Berkeley, California, how could they find out more information about that?
Thank you. If they could go to The Economics of Happiness, all one word, theeconomicsofhappiness.org. Economicsofhappiness.org. They'll find all the information there on the website. There's a full program and so on. And we do also, for activists and so on, we have reduced rates. So if you're interested, please do contact us.
Okay, Helena,
bye-bye.
Thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Richard Belzer, thank you for joining Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, I'm glad you have a soapbox. You should have.
Well, and I like to give other people the soapbox too, because as you know,
yeah, you sure, that's good.
Yeah, voices from alternative to the establishment.
Right.
We don't have very many venues to have a soapbox.
I know, but we're getting more and more responses from the average people about what we've been talking about for years.
Right, and thank goodness for independent media, so we do have this chance.
It's extraordinary.
Okay, so I called you because I wanted to talk about your newest book, I think, Dead Wrong, Straight Facts on the Country's Most Controversial Cover-Ups. You co-wrote it, and somebody who's also been on my show, Governor Jesse Ventura, wrote the afterword, I believe, to your book. And first of all, let's talk about that phrase, conspiracy theorists. What are your thoughts on that phrase?
Well, the word conspiracy means that, as you know, when two people get together and they discuss committing a crime, that's a conspiracy. By that definition, millions of conspiracies occur every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the American Revolution to Iran Contra to Watergate to the Tuskegee experiments on black servicemen to all kinds of stuff, testing weapons in America. And, you know, by the 50s, we tested our government, tested on our own people different toxins in the New York subway and the San Francisco harbor. So, the word conspiracy has been marginalized and diluted by the mainstream media and part of the government, because if people start seriously thinking about it, you realize that everything virtually is a conspiracy. You know, my philosophy is, prove to me something's not a conspiracy. I go the other way. People say, well, it's not a conspiracy. You have to prove to me it is. I say, prove to me it isn't. And that's how I work. And, I for years I've been interested in these issues. And for years I've been, I'm not crying, I'm just saying I've been marginalized and stuff. But then when I started writing books with footnotes and working with historians, it's gotten much more serious. And actually my last book, the one you have, made the New York Times bestseller list. So, you know, the public is catching on, you know, slowly but surely.
Well, when you were researching the book, did you find anything that shocked or surprised you?
Yes. Actually, my partner, David Wayne, who is incredible, you should have him on your show also. He's an amazing historian and researcher. He found some stuff out about Lyndon Johnson that I thought I knew a lot about Johnson's history. But he discovered some really amazing evidence of Johnson having people assassinated. I knew he was complicitous in eliminating two people, but it seems like there must have been five or six people that at the direct behest of Lyndon Johnson, people were murdered. Also, we found in our book, I think, irrefutably once and for all prove that Marilyn Monroe was in fact murdered and not, that was not a suicide. We got some really great research on that. And in the first chapter of the book, Frank Olson, who was a member of the CIA, he was murdered by the very techniques that he had been working on and was appalled by. Mm-hmm. And his family sued the government in the 70s, and now they're suing them again. Recently, I read in the New York Times, the Olson family is again suing the federal government over the murder of Frank Olson. So it's new. You know, the book is a history book, but now it's topical.
Well, also,
break again.
Also, no, it's okay. There have been some recent things that have been very strange. I was thoroughly raked over the coals when I questioned the recent death of Osama bin Laden in 2011. Have you researched? And it's not like I'm saying who murdered him or that it didn't happen the way they said it happened, but there's been absolutely not one shred of empirical proof that it happened the way they said that it happened.
Yeah, the thing about bin Laden is because he was so despised, I think a lot of researchers don't really care how he died.
Uh-huh.
Or, and to me, I think it's a joke to think that this, you know, 6'4" guy on a dialysis machine in a cave didn't bat. You know, 9/11 clearly was a much more professional. It may have had governments involved in it.
Right.
And I think he, like Saddam Hussein, was a useful boogeyman who was nowhere near the threat we said he did. He was more symbolic than anything else. And who knows? I mean, he was living right next to a major army base in
uh-huh.
a giant compound. So for them to say they didn't know where he was I'm talking about the Pakistanis, was ridiculous. And I'm certain that probably, I'm guessing now, I think the Bush administration really didn't care about getting him or not because he was useful. But I do
mm-hmm.
believe that President Obama really did want to get him, both symbolically and militarily. And I don't know how they did, but I'm certain that he's no longer in existence. He may have died years ago. He may still be
right.
alive in
right.
a hole somewhere. But he's of no threat to us if he ever was.
Right.
In fact, if I may, Cindy, there's great not evidence. I mean, there's clear evidence that Al-Qaeda was invented by us. The United States government gave these terrorists and a small band of terrorists who were refuted by most of the Muslim world, gave them the name Al-Qaeda so they could indict bin Laden the way you could someone in the you know what the RICO Act is in America?
Yeah.
It's about conspiracy. It's about gangsters and colluding to do illegal things. They didn't have anything on bin Laden, so they invented Al-Qaeda, pretending it was like a Casa Nostra or it was a mafia or it was, you know, a terrorist group. Bin Laden himself did not use the term Al-Qaeda until after 9/11. We invented this. It's not an international cell of sleepers all over. If they were, they already would have done their damage. It's a big, well, you know, it's just trying to control us. I'm more worried about. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I'm more worried about white Republican congressmen. They're the real terrorists. They're the ones cutting off. I'm serious. They're cut off.
No, I know what you mean.
They cut off education. They are misogynistic. They are homophobic. They never met a war they didn't like or understand. I mean, they're the terrorists. In my view.
Well, of course, our own government, like Martin Luther King Jr. said. The biggest purveyor of violence in the world today is my own government. So I have...
Yeah.
Exactly. Did you write it? You wrote about him in the book too, right?
Yeah, Dr. King and Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton was one of the unsung heroes of the civil rights movement. He was a Black Panther, but he was nonviolent. He had breakfast programs and he was helping with the schools and legislation and he was massacred,
yeah.
you know. anyway, I'm glad that that the book did as well, because he's one of the few people that more people should know about. Fred Hampton.
When did it become like almost treasonous to question the government?
That's a great question.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if it's ironic, but in the 1980s, I was highly critical of the Reagan administration and was censored, lost jobs, was cut off at on a panel, I was kind of ostracized. At the beginning of Reagan's presidency, everyone, no one was really busting him on anything. And I started talking about Reaganomics, which was, some of it's a little scatological, but I was saying, Reaganomics, food stamps, that tree bark was a vegetable, ketchup is a vegetable, eat tree bark.
Right.
Don't, next time, instead of getting pregnant, have oral sex. I'm cleaning up my act. But essentially what I was saying was that Reaganomics was just a total insult to the poor. Reagan made it okay to be prejudiced again and to demonize the poor. And to me, he is the second worst president. George Bush is the worst president. And I believe Ronald Reagan is the second worst president. I know I could get in debates about that, but I'll stick to my guns. Reagan did a lot of damage to this country. He disassembled every department. He put in all these right-wing ideologues who didn't like government. So when they became the head of education or the head of transportation, they would disassemble the government, essentially. And quietly and stealthily, Reagan kind of, made it okay to demonize the poor. He gave those tax breaks to the rich. He spent $4 trillion on borrowed money against an empire in decline, the Soviet Union. And also the mining of the harbor in Haiphong and the war in Nicaragua, guns for hostages. I mean, Reagan was really, obviously he was controlled by the people around him, but he was a mouthpiece for some real dark forces who were in power and then were out of power and then came back. Cheney and Rumsfeld worked for Ford, worked for Reagan. They came back with their, Iraq plan. They wanted to go into Iraq even before 9/11.
Right.
So this, what really woke me up, Cindy, was when the Watergate break-in happened, I started studying that a little bit, and I saw some of the same names that were involved in the Bay of Pigs. And then when Iran-Contra happened, some of the same names involved in the Bay of Pigs and Watergate came up again, and I realized, oh, Jesus, this is, how naive am I? There, as General Eisenhower said, this beware the national security state. But also in that speech, he said, militarily and spiritually, people don't use that term that Eisenhower used. He said we were in danger spiritually from the military-industrial complex, and damn if he wasn't right. If Eisenhower was afraid, then, a five-star general, he was afraid of the right wing. He was too moderate. He could never be elected today, General Eisenhower.
Right.
Anyway, I do go on.
Well, I just have, I'm so grateful for your time and your flexibility, and I know you're very busy, but I am a huge fan of Stephen King. I have been since I was about 18 years old. And I recently read a book he wrote called 11-22-63 about the assassination of Kennedy. It was a pretty good fictional account, but he said that in the afterword, he said that the only conclusion that a thinking person could come to was about this was that Oswald acted alone. What's your thoughts on that?
I'll tell you, I think Stephen is an absolute genius and a fiction writer. And he seems like a pretty decent guy from his essays and stuff. What I've come across in my many decades of studying the case, going to Dallas, being in the museum, being in the plaza, talking to all kinds of people, listening to lectures and finding obscure pamphlets and reading French books, and just I've really asked my wife.
Okay.
I've really gotten into this. And for anyone in 2013, and it's astounding, especially Stephen, to come to the conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald shot John Kennedy is almost beyond comprehension. First of all, Lee Harvey Oswald was having lunch on the first floor of the book depository. He was seen at 122, 123, and if you want to quibble, by three different people. Now, the reason this is important is because the very few notes that were taken, Oswald was interviewed, but they destroyed many of the notes, but some of the notes still exist, when Chief Curry and others were talking to him. And the little that we have of what Oswald said was, one of the things he said was, they asked him where he was. He said, I was in the lunchroom, and I saw Junior and that other guy. So he named two black employees from the book depository of the many dozens of people that work there. He couldn't have guessed that.
Uh-huh.
So he did, because they said they saw him. Plus, there was a woman, I'm drawing a blank on her name, her last name is Arnold. She was pregnant. She had to go to the ladies' room like every 20 minutes or so. She walked through the lunchroom around 1224, and saw Lee Harvey Oswald. Okay, so that means if he was on the first floor at 1224, he would have had to go on up five flights, which is really 10 because I was there. They have landings, so a flight is really two small flights. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So for him to go from the first floor to the sixth floor and go across the floor of the depository and get into the so-called sniper's nest and fire off the three shots and then go back across and wipe the rifle and place it in behind the boxes, then go back down to the second floor and get a Coke and be calmly drinking it when first seen at 1:30. By Officer Marion and Roy Truly, the manager of the building. So the reason I'm saying all this is because it was physically impossible for Oswald to have fired the shots. So we could debate who ordered it, who did it, but he wasn't involved. He didn't even fire a shot. There's a good theory, which I'm beginning to subscribe to, with all the evidence that keeps coming in, believe it or not, that he definitely worked for our government. He was a fake defector.
Right.
He went to Russia under a program. But he was working for us, and he may have thought he infiltrated the cabal that was going to kill Kennedy, but they use him as a patsy. I think he, you know, because there's good evidence that he liked Kennedy and that the last thing on his mind was killing Kennedy. I mean, he was a fake communist, and, well, you know all that stuff. So, I mean, it's just disturbing to see someone like Stephen say that without really looking at the evidence that's in the public domain. You know, I wrote a book in 99, and I was called crazy and everything and about Kennedy. And much of what I said has been corroborated time and again, and new information came out in 99. 100,000 pages were released, and we learned that there were two brains and that his body was doctored and the x-rays were doctored. And, you know, I mean, I don't know how much proof people need. My belief is this, Sandy, that there are certain realities like the World Trade Center, like the Kennedy murder and the Bobby's murder and Malcolm's murder and Dr. King and where people cannot, for some part of their brain, it's nothing to do with IQ, I've found, they cannot accept the notion that their government would do certain things, and then their brain stops. I have sat with the most really highly intelligent people, really intelligent, and explained to them in detail certain facts that I know to be true, and they can't hear, they don't want to hear it. They laugh, they walk away, or they, you know, I mean, they don't ridicule me, but they just can't accept it. And so I think there's a psychological, I know Tom Hanks right now is making a movie about the JFK assassination. And I know it's going to be, you know, Lee Oswald did it. And it's just, you know what, it's almost criminal, you know, to lie about it. Because what are we going to, you know, say it's on the front page of the New York Times, you know, our government was complicit in the murder of John Kennedy. Most people are going to go, yeah, what's new? We knew that. You know, I mean, people aren't stupid. It's not the 50s where we were all patronizing the citizenry and creating a Red Scare. And, you know, there's 5 million channels. Americans have seen everything. If an alien landed, they'd probably get a talk show in a week and be folded into our society. So this thing of protecting us from stuff is just the government's way of controlling us.
Well, we're indoctrinated almost from the time we're born. So,
literally.
Into this myth. Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
Do you have a pen? Do you have a pen?
I do.
Write this down. Century of the Self. It's a documentary that you can watch, and it's about the invention of public relations. It's absolutely fascinating how public relations was invented and then employed to lie us into wars and to get us to buy products we don't need. And it's in English, obviously English, because the Americans can never do it. It's on YouTube, Cindy. If you go on YouTube, you put in Century of the Self full movie, then you could watch it without it being broken up into, you know, 8-minute chunks.
Mm-hmm.
You could watch it. I highly recommend it.
Okay,
I've been
great.
Studying it. It's called Century of the Self.
I will link that also on the newsletter I send out talking about the show and, of course, also your book. So, Richard Belzer, thank you.
Huh? Can I start getting your newsletter, you said?
Yes.
Can I start getting it?
Yes, I will sign you up for it. I think I have your email. I'll put you on my database. And Richard Belzer, a co-author of Dead Wrong, Straight Facts and the Country's Most Controversial Cover-Ups, among other things. I know you're a very busy person, and we here at the Soapbox are very happy that you gave us some time to talk about these things.
Anytime, Cindy. I have another book coming out in the spring, and I hope to talk to you again.
Oh, perfect. We'll get you back on. Richard Belzer, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. It was great to talk to you.
Take care, Cindy, and thank you.
Well, that's your Soapbox for today, and I hope you enjoyed it. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller, Mikey, my associate producer. I'd like to thank Helena Norberg-Hodge and Richard Belzer for their work and for agreeing to be guests in Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And as always, I'd like to thank you most for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.